Hey, sweetie, your mother showed me this Carvana thing for selling the car. I'm going to give it a try. Wish me luck. Me again. I put in the license plate. It gave me an offer. Unbelievable. Okay, I accepted the offer. They're picking it up Tuesday from the driveway. I haven't even left my chair. It's done. The car is gone. I'm holding a check. Anyway, Carvana, give it a whirl. Love ya.
So good, you'll want to leave a voicemail about it. Sell your car today on
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
A revolution had occurred in the Parthian Empire. The grandees of the kingdom, with the young, bold, and talented Grand Vizier at their head, had overthrown King Mithridates and placed his brother, Orodes, on the throne. Mithridates, therefore, made common cause with the Romans and resorted to the camp of Gabinius. Everything promised the best results to the enterprise of the Roman governor, when he unexpectedly received orders to conduct the king of Egypt back by force of arms to Alexandria. He was obliged to obey, but in the expectation of soon coming back, he induced the dethroned Parthian prince, who solicited aid from him, to commence the war in the meanwhile at his own hand. Mithridates did so, and Seleucia, a city, and Babylon declared for him, but the vizier captured Seleucia by assault, having been in person the first to mount the battlements. And in Babylon, Mithridates himself was forced by famine to surrender, whereupon he was by his brother's orders put to death. His death was a palpable loss to the Romans, but it by no means put an end to the ferment in the Parthian Empire, and the Armenian War continued. Gabinius, after ending the Egyptian campaign, was just on the eve of turning to account the still favourable opportunity of resuming the interrupted Parthian War, when Crassus arrived in Syria, and along with the command, took up also the plans of his predecessor. Full of high-flown hopes, he estimated the difficulties of the march as slight, and the power of resistance in the armies of the enemy as yet slighter. He not only spoke confidently of the subjugation of the Parthians, but he was already in imagination the conqueror of the kingdom of Bactria and India. End quote. So a fair bit there in that, at least that last bit. There is all sorts of conflict going on out in the east, from Armenia down to Egypt. It's actually largely infighting among themselves. And Rome, as always, is sort of playing the game of switching sides and getting involved here and there and trying to manipulate events for their own benefit. But when Crassus turns up, basically, he's like, no, we're going on the all-out attack. Screw them and all the power structures that exist between them. We're just attacking everyone and we're going to take everything. Again, Alexander style. Mompson goes on. The new Alexander, he's being sarcastic there, he's talking about Crassus. The new Alexander, however, was in no haste. Before he carried into effect these great plans, he found leisure for very tedious and very lucrative collateral transactions. That's a polite 19th century way of saying stealing as much money from everyone he could at every opportunity. The temples of Derceto at Hierapolis and of Jehovah at Jerusalem and other such shrines of the Syrian province were by order of Crassus despoiled of their treasures, and contingents, or still better, sums of money, instead, were levied from all the subjects. The military operation of the first summer was limited to an extensive reconnaissance in Mesopotamia. The Euphrates was crossed. The Parthian satrap was defeated at Inchnae, that's near modern-day Raqqa, and the neighbouring towns, including the considerable one at Nicephorium, which is Raqqa, were occupied, after which the Romans, having left garrisons behind in them, returned to Syria. They had hitherto been in doubt whether it was more advisable to march to Parthia by the circuitous route of Armenia or by the direct route through the Mesopotamian desert. The first route, leading through mountainous regions under the control of trustworthy allies, commended itself by its greater safety. King Artavasdes came in person to the Roman headquarters to advocate this plan of the campaign. But that reconnaissance decided in favour of the march through Mesopotamia. The numerous and flourishing Greek and half-Greek towns in the region along the Euphrates and Tigris, above all the great city of Seleucia, were altogether adverse to the Parthian rule. All the Greek townships with which the Romans came into contact had now, like the citizens of Carrhae at an earlier time, practically shown how ready they were to shake off the intolerable foreign yoke and to receive the Romans as deliverers, almost as countrymen. The Arab prince, Abgarus, who commanded the desert of Edessa and Krahe, and thereby the usual route from the Euphrates to the Tigris, had arrived in the camp of the Romans to assure them in person of his devotedness. The Parthians had appeared to be wholly unprepared. Accordingly, the Euphrates was crossed. To reach the Tigris from this point, they had the choice of two routes. Either the army might move downwards along the Euphrates to the latitude of Seleucia, where the Euphrates and Tigris are only a few miles distant from each other, or they might immediately, after crossing, take the shortest line to the Tigris, right across the great Mesopotamian desert. The former route led directly to the Parthian capital, Ctesiphon, which is near-ish Baghdad, which lay opposite Seleucia on the other bank of the Tigris. Several weighty voices were raised in favour of this route in the Roman Council of War. In particular, the quaestor Gaius Cassius, he's going to become an important character in this story, Cassius. Monson continues, Cassius pointed to the difficulties of the march in the desert and to the suspicious reports arriving from the Roman garrisons on the left bank of the Euphrates as to the Parthian warlike preparations. But in opposition to this, the Arab prince Abgarus announced that the Parthians were employed in evacuating their western provinces. They had already packed up their treasures and put themselves in motion to flee to Scythia, i.e. just further, deeper into Central Asia. Only through a forced march by the shortest route was it at all possible still to reach them. But by such a march, the Romans would probably succeed in overtaking and cutting up at least the rear guard of the great army under the vizier and obtaining enormous spoil, which of course was something Crassus was very, very interested in. These reports of the friendly Bedouins decided the direction of march. The Roman army, consisting of 7 legions, 4,000 cavalry, and 4,000 slingers and archers, turned off from the Euphrates and away into the inhospitable plains of northern Mesopotamia, end quote. It's probably something like 40,000 men, probably something in that region. So a big army, 40,000 men is pretty big. And Crassus has decided to march them straight into the desert of southwestern Turkey or northern Iraq. Completely inhospitable deserts. There's deserts and then there's real badass deserts. This is one of those no joke badass deserts where it's kind of crazy to march men into it. If you're an Arab Bedouin and you know about making long marches through the desert and you're all mounted on camels and you know exactly where the oases are and all that sort of thing, then maybe, just about maybe, okay. But if you don't really know what you're doing and men are on foot and you haven't made the great provisions for water, then that's crazy. That was a crazy decision for Crassus to make. It's hubris, or it's his desire for glory and spoils, which seems to have blinded him. And he was told by Cassius, his most important lieutenant, not to do that. That's crazy. You don't march an army of Romans into a Mesopotamian desert. You don't do that. But Crassus was the CO. He was the overall commanding officer. So that was the decision he made. Let Plutarch pick up the story. He says this, and now information which deserved to be taken seriously began to come in from various people who had been in the Mesopotamian cities garrisoned by the Romans and who, at great risk, had managed to make their way out. They had seen with their own eyes how large the enemy forces were and what methods of warfare they employed in their attacks on the cities. As usually happens, their reports made things appear even more terrible than they really were. These people, they said, are impossible to shake off if they are in pursuit and impossible to overtake if they are in flight. They employ a new kind of missile. This is an interesting bit of Plutarch. People have always thought, they're not sure really what he means here. It must just be exaggeration or hyperbole. He said, they employ a new kind of missile, which travels faster than sight and pierces through whatever is in the way before one can see who is discharging these weapons. And their armoured cavalry has weapons of offence, which will cut through everything, and offensive equipment, which will stand up to any blow. That's interesting. Not really sure what the missile weapons is talking about there, because they didn't have anything particularly special. They did have quite good bows, though, better bows than the Romans or anyone in the West. And they were great horsemen, brilliant horsemen. Same old story. The peoples from Central Asia or Scythia are always great on a horse. I mean, brilliant. They're bred in the saddle. And one thing they could do is turn round in the saddle while still galloping away from you, turn round and shoot back at you. The famous Parthian shot. So even if you're trying to pursue them, you probably won't catch them because they're better on horses than you are. Even if you try to do that, they'll still be shooting at you accurately from the saddle. Yeah, the classic Parthian shot. Plutarch continues. This news had a most depressing effect on the soldiers' spirits, the Roman soldiers. Up to now, they had believed that the Parthians were just the same as the Armenians or even the Cappadocians, whom Lucullus had gone on plundering until he was tired of it. And they had imagined that the main difficulties of the campaign would be the long journey and the pursuing of troops who would not come to close quarters. Now, however, they found themselves in the unexpected position of having to face real fighting and great danger. Some of the officers, amongst whom was Cassius the Quaestor, thought that Crassus ought to call a halt and reconsider the whole undertaking. The professional prophets also quietly spread the news that at their sacrifices, the omens for Crassus were invariably bad and inauspicious. But Crassus paid no attention to them or to anyone else who gave any advice other than to press forward, end quote. So Crassus can see that he hasn't got great morale in his army. And that's a massive thing in all armies at all times. Or even just in a boxing match or an MMA fight. If you feel yourself beaten, you are half beaten already. If you're really, really scared of the enemy, if you haven't got confidence in your own abilities, you're going to have a tough time of it. And it seems that that's just what happened in Crassus's army. For whatever reason, they didn't have a lot of faith in themselves. They didn't have a lot of faith in Crassus. That's one thing both Pompey and Caesar, but particularly Caesar, enjoyed. People had complete confidence in him. Even when he found himself massively outnumbered and surrounded and it looked like everything was lost, almost with just a word from Caesar, saying, you know, we got this, guys. We got this. Don't worry. The men would just say, okay, great. Yeah. Caesar's got confidence, so that's good enough for me. Crassus did not enjoy that sort of confidence from his men and officers. Crassus, it seems, was just filled with sort of a kind of arrogance at this point, again, which is out of character for the rest of his life and career. He just wouldn't listen to anyone else. And he even talks about after they cross the Euphrates that he will destroy the bridge they just built behind them, so men can't retreat. You know, we're committed to this. But it had the sort of the wrong effect. Instead of galvanizing the men and getting them all on board, it just scares them even more. Plutarch then says, quote, he then marched along the river with 7 legions, nearly 4,000 cavalry, and about the same number of light troops. His scouts had been taking reconnaissance, and some of them now came back and reported that there was no men to be seen in the area, but that they had come across the tracks of a great number of horses, which appeared to have wheeled around and have fled when pursued. So that's sort of ominous, isn't it? Can't see any of the enemy cavalry, but you know they're around. They must be in the area somewhere. Yeah, very ominous. Plutarch continues, quote, Crassus was still considering and weighing up these arguments when an Arab chieftain called Argobus put in an appearance. This Argobus was a sly, treacherous character. Indeed, he played the greatest and the most decisive part in all that combination of evil which fortune had designed for the destruction of the Romans. A few paragraphs later, Plutarch continues, now Argobus succeeded in getting him, Crassus, to do as he wished. He drew him away from the river and led him right into the open plains. At first, the route was a good one and the going was easy. Soon, however, the march became difficult as they entered a district where there was deep sand underfoot, a level plain with no trees and no water, going on so far as the eye could see forever. The men were not only exhausted by thirst, but by the difficulties of the march. They were also overcome by a kind of sullen despair when they looked around them, for there was not a single growing thing in sight, not a stream, not a sign of any rising ground, not a blade of grass. There was a sea of sand and nothing else, and the desert billows of this sea were sweeping around the army on every side. This in itself was enough to make them suspect that they were being tricked. So as Plutarch tells us there, the men were under no illusions. Like, you know, what is this? We don't just march into endless deserts like this. This is mad. And Cassius saw it as well. But for some reason, Crassus himself believed what this Arab leader, Abgarus, was telling him. For some reason, he bought into all Abgarus's lies. But Cassius was sort of having none of it. Plutarch says, quote, Cassius once again strongly disapproved, Seeing that his attitude only annoyed Crassus, he gave up trying to advise him, but he took the native chieftain aside and spoke to him without mincing his words. "What evil spirit have you brought upon us, you villain?" he said. "What drugs and sorceries have you been using to persuade Crassus to pour his army into a great yawning wilderness and to follow a route that is better fitted for a captain of Arabian robbers than for a Roman imperator?" The native, however, was full of cunning. Putting on the most humble air, he tried to encourage them and beg them to endure for a little longer. He would run alongside and beside the soldiers, helping them with their tasks, laughing and making jokes. "Do you think you are marching through Campania?" he would say. "Are you longing for the fountains and streams there and the shady places? Yes, the baths and the taverns. Oh no, you must remember that the country you are going through is the borderland between Assyria and Arabia." So the native managed the Romans as if they were children and rode off himself before his treachery was discovered. He went with the full knowledge of Crassus. In fact, he had actually persuaded Crassus that he was going to work in his interests by sowing confusion in the minds of the enemy, end quote. So after leading them into the middle of a utterly unforgiving desert, he then rides off and leaves them. And Crassus even allowed him to do it because he just believed everything this guy was telling him. It's really naive, in the end, sort of suicidally naive. Mompson tells us about this march through the desert. Quote, "Far and wide, not an enemy showed himself. Only hunger and thirst and the endless sandy desert seemed to keep watch at the gates of the east. At length, after many days of toilsome marching, not far from the first river which the Roman army had to cross, the Balasus, today the Belic, the first horsemen of the enemy were described. Abgarus with his Arabs was sent out to reconnoitre. The Parthian squadrons retired up to and over the river and vanished in the distance, pursued by Abgarus and his followers. With impatience, the Romans waited for his return and for more exact information. The general hoped here at length to come upon the constantly retreating foe. His young and brave son, Publius, who had fought with the greatest distinction in Gaul under Caesar, and had been sent by the latter at the head of a Celtic squadron of horse to take part in the Parthian War, was inflamed with a vehement desire for the fight. When no tidings came, they resolved to advance at a venture. The signal for starting was given, and the Balasus was crossed. The army, after a brief insufficient rest at noon, was led on without delay at a rapid pace. Then suddenly the kettle drums of the Parthians sounded all around. On every side their silken gold embroidered banners were seen waving, and their iron helmets and coats of mail glittering in the blaze of the hot noonday sun. And by the side of the vizier stood Prince Abgarus with his Bedouins, end quote. So suddenly the Parthian army shows itself, shows its hand, and Crassus finds himself in a sticky situation. He's completely fallen for the trap, hook, line and sinker. Plutarch says that, quote, Crassus himself was absolutely thunderstruck, end quote. Crassus sort of couldn't really believe it. It's a bit like, it reminds me of that story when Stalin got news that Hitler had broken the Nazi-Soviet pact and had invaded Soviet territory. Stalin just sort of couldn't believe it. Everyone had been telling Stalin for ages that this was going to happen, or that it has in fact started to happen, and he just refused to believe it. And when it became clear that it just was, there was no denying it anymore, he just was thunderstruck, just couldn't believe it. Or apart from anything else, it's sort of humiliating, isn't it? It sort of shows that your judgment is terrible. It shows that you believed a liar far longer than you should have done when everyone around you could see it. Well, so Crassus forms up into square, basically his whole army into a giant square, because the Parthians very quickly almost surround them. Not completely surround them, but at least start to flank them on three sides. Well, actually, so at first Crassus forms up in a massive long line, a giant line of battle. But he sees that the Parthians outnumber them, and they're all mounted. They're basically nearly all mounted, and they start to outflank them despite how long Crassus's battle line is. So he changes his mind and forms them into a giant square, you know, like a nearly 40,000 man strong square, and starts moving along slowly in this square. Plutarch says, quote, he began to make his dispositions hurriedly and without much consistency. First, he followed the advice of Cassius, and with a view to preventing the enemy from surrounding them, extended his line of infantry as far as possible across the plain without giving it much depth. and dividing all the cavalry between the two wings. Then he changed his mind and concentrated his forces into a compact body, forming them up in a hollow square, ready to face in four directions, and with 12 cohorts on each side. To each cohort, a squadron of cavalry was assigned, so that no part of the line might be without the support of cavalry, and the whole force could advance with equal protection everywhere. But Cassius, in command of one of the wings, and the young Crassus, this is Crassus's son, Publius, in command of the other, while he himself took up his position in the centre. In this formation, they marched forward until they came to a stream called the Basilus. It was a small stream in any case, and now there was not much water in it. But by this time, it was a pleasant enough sight to the soldiers, who were hot and thirsty after their hard march without water at all. It was therefore the opinion of most of the officers that they should camp there for the night, and after finding out what they could about the numbers of the enemy and their order of battle, advanced against them at dawn. Crassus, however, was carried away by the eagerness of his son and of the cavalry who were with him, and who were all in favour of pressing on and engaging the enemy. He therefore gave orders that those who need to do so should eat and drink, standing as they were in their ranks. And even before they had all had time to do this, he again led them forward. Instead of making them march slowly and halting from time to time, as is usual when on the way to battle, he kept up a quick pace until the enemy came into sight. The Romans were surprised to observe that they were neither so numerous nor so splendidly armed as they had expected. This was, in fact, because the vizier, this is sort of the grand vizier of the Parthian army, because the vizier had hidden his main force behind the front ranks and had ordered them to cover themselves with coats and skins so as to conceal the glittering of their armour. Now, when they were near the Romans and their general gave the signal, first of all, the whole plain was filled with a deep and terrifying roaring sound, for the Parthians, instead of having horns or trumpets to sound the attack, made use of hollow drums of stretched hide to which bronze bells were attached. They beat on these drums all at once in many different parts of the field, and the sound produced is most eerie and terrifying, like the roaring of wild animals with something of the sharpness of a peal of thunder. They have, it seems, correctly observed that the sense of hearing has the most disturbing effect on us of all our senses, most quickly arouses our emotions and most effectively overpowers our judgment. Before the Romans had recovered from their consternation at this din, the enemy suddenly dropped the coverings of their armour. Now they could be seen clearly, their helmets and breastplates blazing like fire, their Marginian steel glittering keen and bright, their horses armoured with plates of bronze and steel, end quote. So there's one particular type of cavalry the Parthians have got, which are really, really, really heavily armoured, a bit like medieval knights. It says they're sort of armoured from head to toe in sort of chainmail, not necessarily sort of medieval plate mail, but they're just heavily armoured, and even their horses are armoured. So it's like heavy cavalry. The Romans hadn't really seen the like of it before, not like this anyway. Just to say quickly, the Romans and the Parthians hadn't really come into large-scale contact before, big, big, massive set-piece battles with giant 10,000-man-a-side armies like this. So they're sort of feeling each other out for the first time. So the grand Parthian vizier starts trying to surround this square, as I said, and in order to try and avoid that, Crassus decides he has to break out, send a contingent of his men to break out of this giant square.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Hey, sweetie, your mother showed me this Carvana thing for selling the car. I'm going to give it a try. Wish me luck. Me again. I put in the license plate. It gave me an offer. Unbelievable. Okay, I accepted the offer. They're picking it up Tuesday from the driveway. I haven't even left my chair. It's done. The car is gone. I'm holding a check. Anyway, Carvana, give it a whirl. Love ya.
So good, you'll want to leave a voicemail about it. Sell your car today on
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.